Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Melanie Robbins. She's the Senior Associate Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League of New York. Among other activities of the league is the tracking of anti-Semitic incidents across the state and across the United States. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just start with some basics. Give our listeners a brief background on the Anti-Defamation League, its history, its mission, and some of its current activities.
Sure. So the mission of the Anti-Defamation League is to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment for all. We are a 100-plus-year-old organization pursuing agenda items kind of across the spectrum of civil rights issues, notably on the issue of hate crimes. We do a lot of educational work. We also work very closely with law enforcement. And so we address the issues of hate kind of initially through the lens of anti-Semitism, which is where we kind of were founded from. Mm-hmm. But as you heard in that mission, it has always had a dual mission, right? And that was really kind of prophetic in some ways for an organization that was established in the early 20th century. And we have always understood that if minorities anywhere are under threat, so too is the Jewish community, and vice versa. And this is something that I'm sure we'll touch upon again today as we look at the current situation that we're in. But we have a lot of different areas of our work, including, you know, our work on anti-Semitism. But again, that is just one way that we address hate more broadly through education, advocacy, and our work even investigating extremism and working to train law enforcement on these issues as well.
Great. And is there anything specific to the New York chapter as opposed to other chapters around the country that people should know?
So we are a nationwide organization, as you referenced. We have 26 regional offices and an office in Israel. Here in New York, we cover all of New York State. And we also have a very important focus on inclusivity and kind of interfaith and intergroup engagement, as we call it. So we are working very closely with community partners so that our advocacy work is not only in the halls of Congress or here in the state legislature, but also in our communities, building up coalitions and, you know, meaningful partnerships to address our shared issues and concerns in our communities.
And where does your organization get its funding from?
We have a diverse range of supporters. There are institutions that support it, you know, foundations, but predominantly our support is from individuals and, you know, people from our communities that understand the importance of the work that we do and want to continue to see that work happen. In fact, over the last 2 years, we've seen a phenomenal jump in, you know, new supporters and continued supporters after they understood, you know, just how vital our voice was following, you know, the events of Charlottesville and so forth. So there's a lot of, you know, individual support that makes this work happen.
And you mentioned in your description that your organization looks at hate crimes and statements of hate and actions of hatred against a variety of groups, but the Jewish group being sort of the central one, and then things come off of there and they're related back and forth to each other. And I was struck by looking at some of the activities of the organization that you take a stand on a variety of issues. I mean, you've taken stands on immigration, the Trump administration's travel ban. And has that always been, do you know, has that always been a signature aspect of the organization to have that broad portfolio, or has that been something that has changed in recent years?
Well, I think both are kind of correct, right? So our mission has always had a broader scope, and during different times of our nation's history, we have certainly emphasized different areas of our work. I mean, we've been active on, you know, voting issues or equal access issues, right? So we filed an amicus brief in Brown v. Board of Education. You know, our CEO of the time, you know, Ben Epstein, walked with, you know, MLK and Heschel and was, you know, very active in the civil rights movement. So there have certainly been different times in our history that we have emphasized different parts of that mission. I think today what we see is that the scope and just broad impact of hate has really encouraged this need to look at this in more ways than one. So that's, you know, part of the rise in the importance of our work in the Center on Extremism, for example, our briefings with law enforcement, you know, on these issues. But as I said earlier, this underlying mission has always kind of seen that hate is correlated one to the other. If one community is feeling targeted, other communities are too. So while we are founded in our Jewish tradition and community, we've always understood that if we're only for ourselves, that's not going to fix the problem either. And so we've always understood that we need to be working together and in coalition. And this is why actually we spearheaded, you know, a campaign to actually create hate crime legislation and laws across the country, so at the federal level, but also in state legislators. And that was something that we did in coalition with many other civil rights organizations, but just one of these examples of places in which we have to be working together, because it's not just affecting, you know, one person or one community. It's truly impacting us all.
Yeah, you mentioned MLK a little bit earlier, and I'm reminded as you're speaking of, you know, one of the famous quotes, which I'll probably garble here, but basically, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and it reminds me of that kind of approach.
Definitely.
So, your organization recently issued a report on anti-Semitic incidents in 2017, and it found that the number of reported incidents across the country increased by 57%, reaching its highest level in over two decades. And then the incidents of these of anti-Semitic expressions almost doubled in New York State last year, 380 reported and 54 of those in upstate New York. Do I have that basically correct?
It's actually 66 in upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
Which was an increase, a pretty significant increase from the year before.
Right. And so that leads me to one of my questions about those numbers then. What was the trend for upstate similar to downstate? It sounds like it went up everywhere across the state.
It did. It went up everywhere across the state. You know, if you look at the numbers, let's take, you know, Manhattan or New York City, for example. So the numbers actually were a match from New York City to the rest of the state as well, both going not exact match. It was about 91.8% in New York City proper in the boroughs and 90% across the state. But very close, as you can see. So what we also saw was a shift in some places of where more incidents were occurring. Typically, you know, Brooklyn has been, you know, the number one location for incidents. That is also just in part due to the, you know, population size of the Jewish community there. And, you know, having worked in this community for a long time, people being willing and able to come forward and, you know, make these reports. For the first time, though, we saw Manhattan kind of take the lead in terms of the number of incidents, which was very surprising and troubling to the community here, who often had not really seen or felt or heard a lot of this kind of anti-Semitism in their day-to-day life. Suddenly was really, you know, literally on their doorstep. And then we also saw a significant increase in other boroughs like Queens and, like I mentioned, as well as upstate, up from about 13 in the year prior to, like I mentioned, 66 in this this past year in 2017.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Melanie Robbins from the Anti-Defamation League of New York. Did the type or intensity of those incidents change in any remarkable ways?
So we definitely saw an increase in vandalism, and that leading the way of most of the incidents that we, you know, tracked. And that to us really represents a kind of broad issue that we have seen, which is this emboldenment, people who feel more able, more free to express hateful and bigoted ideas and present it, you know, in public spaces in ways that they didn't necessarily feel as able to do before. So, you know, a number of those incidents also have taken place in our schools, in the K-12 schools, as well as on college campuses. And so what we're seeing there is that these don't necessarily all represent, you know, hardened neo-Nazis or white supremacists, although we do see a rise in, you know, those who affiliate with those kinds of ideologies. But what we're actually seeing are, you know, students and members of our community who maybe would feel like they had to keep it under wraps before, feeling like they can just openly and proudly kind of share these bigoted and hateful views. And this is what is really concerning to us, because it is a shift in our communities and in our culture. And, you know, it's not, again, to kind of bring this back to the broader impacts, right? So if the Jewish community is being targeted today, it also leaves, especially for students, right? If I'm a student and I'm looking at my classmate who's being targeted for being Jewish, and I myself may be a Muslim or a Hispanic, and I say, oh my goodness, if they're today, it could be me tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have this kind of pending fear that is sitting in our students and also with, you know, teachers who are in these classrooms who have also been, you know, targeted with anti-Semitic incidents from their own students who have learned it from other places, whether that be from, you know, the media or at home or what have you. But again, that's really representative of this emboldenment that we're seeing.
And you mentioned seeing more incidents in Manhattan and the outer boroughs or other boroughs than Brooklyn. And then you were just talking there about classroom experiences of different kinds. I was wondering whether there have been any kind of changes in the type of places where you see the activity, not necessarily like Manhattan versus Brooklyn, but perhaps schools as opposed to, you know, where it had been seen before, or anything that struck you in that way in looking at recent figures.
Sure. So we definitely saw, like I said, the increased targeting of college campuses and universities. Mm-hmm. We saw an increase of targeting around schools. So incidents between students, but also, like I said before, vandalism of actual school institutions. And these are not necessarily just Jewish schools, you know, Jewish day schools or things like that. These are public schools, playgrounds, for example, if you're thinking again of where youth are. But we also saw a major increase in the targeting of houses of worship that, again, are not necessarily synagogues, but, you know, other houses of worship, especially here in New York City, where you do have communities that share a house of worship. So we had a number of incidents where you would see a swastika that is on a building that is a shared, you know, house of worship to a church and to a local synagogue or what have you. Or even in some cases, you know, just, you know, the public places, subways, trains, things like that. Those are kind of the similar numbers, I would say, to what we had seen last year. But what was really unique was this kind of growth on targeting of other houses of worship that are not necessarily only synagogues, although we, of course, saw, you know, with the bomb threats that took place early last year, a huge increase in terms of institutions being targeted, particularly in that case, Jewish institutions.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Melanie Robbins. She's the Senior Associate Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League of New York. Well, you had talked before, Melanie, about it seeming like people were feeling just more empowered and less hesitant to put these things out there in comparison to the past. So the big question, of course, is, you know, why is that happening? Why do you think that there has been this really significant uptick in these kinds of incidents in the last few years?
Sure, thanks. So one thing I want to make really clear, and, you know, it seems silly sometimes to just lay it out as simply as it is, but anti-Semitism is real, and it's growing, especially among certain segments of society. So we have to start by kind of just at least recognizing and understanding that. We see it every day, and it's widespread. And so this growth is certainly part of that emboldenment that we're seeing. But, you know, one thing that people often raise is, okay, well, you know, maybe there's an increased awareness of these issues, and so people are reporting more. That is certainly part of the answer, but there's a confluence of factors that we believe are contributing to the increase. So I mentioned before kind of this notion, the diminishment of civility in society, whether that was the rhetoric around the election or what has happened kind of since the election. We definitely see that diminishment of civility in our discourse, and we believe that is, you know, part of the issue. As I mentioned, there's certainly an extent in which reporting has increased, but that does not explain a 90% increase for sure. And part of the emboldenment is, like I said before, about the schools, but we also saw it on the national level. So whether that was, you know, Charlottesville or others, in fact, we tracked over 76 events in 2017 that white supremacists had organized, attended, and protested at. So we're seeing, you know, candidates, alt-right, or those, you know, neo-Nazis openly running for Congress, like we saw in Illinois. So you're seeing kind of a platform being given in new ways and in different ways than what we've seen, in addition to these other concerning issues around, you know, the civility and the fact that, of course, there is an actual issue here to begin with. In addition to that, you know, you have copycat effects. You certainly have seen, you know, conspiracy theorists going out there and, again, gaining more traction than I think we've seen, as you also think about, you know, online hate. This is a huge area of our work, is looking at hate online and how we can address it and combat it. But that's certainly been a factor in all of this as well. People have a platform now that they don't need to do very much to get out there, right? You just have to keep being accessing your digital platforms and using them, and people really respond to that. So that's certainly another part of the issue.
Yeah, I was wondering about that last point that you just made when I was thinking about this on my own, that there may be some kind of progression of emboldenment that starts with online conversations and then gets taken offline, and that the more that we see of this, then it's kind of a pathway toward more expressions of these kinds of things. Do you think there's something to that?
Certainly. And we see it. You know, the incidents that we get here that I see in our New York office alone, we get incidents where, you know, students start by bullying each other in various online platforms, whether it's Snapchat or Facebook or, you know, some of the newer forms as well. And that has actually led to assaults, to harassment, or, you know, continued harassment. So we've certainly started to see, at least from a qualitative place, I can say 100% that we're seeing this happening, where it starts online, but it's, again, coming into the real world, whether that is at the local level or at the national level, when we saw, you know, the organizing of the groups in something like Charlottesville, which was really a unique moment, because it was the first time that everyone in the alt-right movement had kind of come together and come offline and showed their faces in the real world. And that, you know, unfortunately ended the way that it did, with violence and, you know, the death of Heather Heyer. And so it is certainly a big concern, and something that we are consistently monitoring and working with law enforcement partners to ensure that when we see, you know, rising threats online and serious threats online, that we are working with law enforcement to hopefully avoid any, you know, future violence as well. We've certainly had cases like that here in New York in addition.
And you mentioned copycat behavior a little bit earlier as well. And, you know, this is always a conundrum, I think, for thinking about the way the media reports things when it comes to behavior that we don't want to have, that you want the media to be paying attention to this because it's important and we need to focus our collective attention on the problem. At the same time, it exposes this behavior to more people. And I don't know if you have a thought about that, or how, you know, we should be thinking about where to come down on that. But it seems like there's a double edge to that you can't really escape.
There's certainly some truth to that. And, you know, it is just, I think, one of the catch-22s of the world that we're in. But we definitely see the importance, and consistently encourage our elected officials, our leaders, our clergy, and, you know, other public figures to call out and expose hate when they see it. On our end, our work to monitor this work, and, you know, again, I would emphasize that this kind of hatred comes from the extreme left and it comes from the extreme right. And, you know, we need to be calling out it from all angles. This is not a partisan issue. But we do really, you know, need the media also to be covering this, so that we're aware of just how impactful and devastating in times, you know, these scenarios can be, these incidents and the impacts that it have on our community, and hopefully bring the conversation back to a place where we can have an actual civil conversation about the issues. But the awareness raising piece is very important, and it leads us also to new ways to fight back, right? So even if we look at fighting hate online, the best way to do that is to know what our challenges are, and part of that process is just by, you know, different reports on the issues. And of course we do that internally, but it certainly helps when it comes from other places as well.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Melanie Robbins of the Anti-Defamation League of New York. Well, there are a lot of citizens in this country who are very worried about these trends. And some of that worry, I think, has been channeled into political activism. And some of that political activism has been partisan. Some of it hasn't. I'm curious to hear what you would suggest to people who are concerned about this. What can they do beyond or outside of political activity, perhaps, to help address the issue?
Well, there's a lot of things people can do. It can begin, you know, even in your day-to-day interactions, making sure that when you see something that is concerning, you know, vandalism or graffiti that is hateful against any community, to make sure that you report that. I think that is the, you know, most basic thing that people can be doing and one of the most important things people can be doing. It's important that you denounce it and expose it. That's reporting to law enforcement. And those are around, you know, actual hate crimes as well as, you know, bias incidents. Sometimes we do need to make sure that that is reported upon as well. So just making sure that you call things out as you see them is one simple step that everyone can take. And there are ways that you can be an ally, you know, right there in your local community. And that will look different, you know, to each person. But being cognizant of how you can be supportive to, you know, members of your community. And then there are ways to be more actively engaged, right? Bringing anti-bias and anti-bullying programs into your school system. So like I mentioned before, one of our core areas of work is our A World of Difference Institute, where we go into schools and we train teachers and students and administrations on, you know, how to educate towards, you know, anti-bias, addressing implicit bias in our schools and in ourselves, and also on bullying and cyberbullying. So making sure that you help bring resources when they're needed. And then there's just staying up to date, as you said, kind of on the political side, but following policy issues that matter to you, whether that's voting rights or, you know, hate crime legislation. You know, in fact, just here in New York, there's a recent legislation that was introduced to require all law enforcement agencies in the state to do hate crimes trainings, right? So reaching out to your local legislators and making sure that they hear from you to support things that matter. These are all definitely ways that you can be involved. And when I say report hate, I also mean reporting hate online. Everyone has to be part of, you know, the public square when they're out there and calling these things out in the digital world as well as the physical world. One of the resources that we have at ADL is a database of how to actually report on the various platforms that people use today. And we work very closely with the tech companies. And so if there is an issue and we see that their reporting procedure isn't addressing it, you know, we do have that ability to work with that platform and find a way to address the issue. So it is so important that we receive those kinds of reports and that we work together to make them more accessible and safe for everyone who's using them.
I want to squeeze a couple questions in at the end, but the first of these is if you could tell me a little bit more about the work that you do with law enforcement. You mentioned that at the very outset. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about what kinds of things you do with the police force and district attorney's offices and so on.
Sure. So we're actually the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement, and we do that through a variety of different programs. One of them is our Law Enforcement and Society program, which actually all of the new FBI recruits out of D.C. Attend. And, you know, locally we do this program also in Long Island with the Holocaust Center and Tolerance Museum in Nassau and with all of the academy trainees in Nassau and Suffolk County. And this is a program really to look at the core values of being a community police force and what does that look like today and how does that how can we learn from the history of World War II and looking at, you know, the implications in today's world. We also do work on hate crimes trainings, like I mentioned before, very supportive to agencies and ensuring that they have the resources to make sure that they know how to report and to address, you know, the procedural side of investigating and ideally prosecuting, you know, hate crimes when they come across their desks. And that's from, you know, a local precinct level to high-level command as well. We also do implicit bias training for law enforcement, which is a newer program that we have recently rolled out across the country and something that we're very excited to be engaging in because it's such a core part of of, you know, the values of community policing, and something that we have been doing anyways for decades with our educational work. And so we're now just bringing it into kind of a different way and place of doing, you know, this implicit bias education. And then last, we take our Center on Extremism and do briefings for law enforcement on very specific kind of issues, depending on what are the needs of that law enforcement agency. If they're concerned about domestic extremism, you know, we just put out a report at the end of last year as well, kind of looking back at the year of extremists and actually finding that white supremacy was the largest domestic extremist threat. And so we will work with law enforcement to kind of look at those threat assessments as well. And then we just work on the day-to-day, you know, with different partners like the NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force when it comes, or other bias units, you know, across the state, to ensure that when there are incidents of anti-Semitism, that they're aware of it. Sometimes community members feel more comfortable to come and report to us, and we obviously encourage always to report to law enforcement as well, but sometimes, you know, people need that support to do so, and so we work with them very closely on various cases related to hate crimes in New York State.
Just have literally 10 seconds left, but I wanted to squeeze this last one in. Do you worry where we are as a country and where we might be going?
I am not worried. I believe that this is a moment in which we're going to all look back on and say, wow, we made it through, and it was so important that we did. I'm a mother of two young kids, and I do look at this question every day, but I do believe this is an important process, and that we're airing concerns that are important to the advancement of our communities and our society, and we're doing the good fight, and I'm positive about that.
Well, I'm happy to hear your optimism. That was Melanie Robbins. It's important work. Melanie, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.